The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disorders of Hemostasis is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
So, we'll do thrombocytopenia, low platelets, and other platelet disorders. So when you're thinking about thrombocytopenia, think about why do we have thrombocytopenia? Is it a decreased production, increased consumption, destruction, dilution, or sequestration? So when you're in the hospital, you have the acutely ill patient. Do they have low platelets because of sepsis? Do they have low platelets because of drugs such as heparin or antibiotics? Are they diluted because of fluid resuscitation? Or have they gone on to develop DIC or TTP? If those patients are sick enough to be in your ICU, they're sick enough to develop DIC or TTP. So let's talk about heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So this is made with diagnosis where your platelet count falls to less than 150,000 five or more days after starting heparin. There's a caveat. If that patient is a frequent flyer at your hospital, they've seen heparin in the past 6 months, they can get this with the first heparin infusion, injection, or whatever you give them. And so that could throw you off if you're not thinking about when they last had heparin. These patients can have thrombotic complications, rule out other causes. There can be more than one reason a person is thrombocytopenic, so you got to think about all of them. And you may not have the luxury of time to wait for that serological test to return showing that you have HIP. So let's think about the frequency. The studies actually show us that it's not very common. So on fractionated heparin, 2.6% of the time. Low molecular weight heparin, 0.2% of the time. And fondaparinux, much less than that. So first thing, if you suspect that this is the case, stop your heparin, including your low molecular weight heparin. So there's two treatments that have been used in the past, but agatroban is usually the most common one that's used nowadays. It's a thrombin inhibitor, and you got to think about your patients who may have liver failure as it has hepatic clearance. Sometimes patients have been started on fondaparinux, which is Erixtra, and on these are the patients that you don't want to start your warfarin acutely. You need to wait until your platelet count recovers because you'll increase your risk of those patients developing limb gangrene. Moving over to DIC, so a variety of causes can cause this. If the patient's sick enough, like I said, to be in the intensive care unit, they're sick enough to develop it. And so you need to look at your patient and decide what's really going on. Do they have multi-system organ failure, septicemia? Do they have low platelets, elevated D-dimer, but normal INR? Then these are the things that you have to think about. And what's important is, has the patient gone on to develop bleeding or thrombosis? So this is some criteria that's, even though this was published in 2001, it's still valid today. Think about what the patient has, and then do your criteria. And then if it's 5 or greater, it's compatible with overt DIC. If it's less, then recheck it in another day or so. You're not going to just, you know, not recheck things, but just continue to follow to see what develops. So these patients can have, like I said, increased risk for bleeding, and that's if they have alpha-2 antitrypsin depletion or thrombosis if they have depletion of their antithrombin 3 and as well as protein CNS. So the treatment, as always, treat the underlying disorder. These patients may need platelets, cryoprecipitate, or fresh frozen plasma if they're bleeding and have very low levels of platelets or fibrinogen. Heparin may be indicated if there's complications of thrombosis present. But think about what's going on, because if they're at high risk for bleeding, such as head injury, you don't want to just put them on heparin. And then you may just need a prophylactic dose if they're non-bleeding and critically ill. So avoid anti-fibrinolytic therapy unless the patient has leukemia or trauma. Antithrombin or recombinant thrombomodulin can be considered in some patients. And then I think the most important thing is, when these patients are getting so complicated, make sure you have your local hematologist involved. TTP, it's usually due to autoantibodies against plasma protease atom TS13, that this protease cleaves the ultra-large von Willebrand multimers. And then there can be a congenital deficiency of this. So looking at this cartoon, the blood flow is normal. On the top, on the right, you have normal hemostasis with the normal atoms TS13. When you have no atoms TS13, you have the thrombosis going on there. So the etiology can be the primary congenital deficiency, or you can have primary but triggered by a disease disorder. Secondary, think about your drugs. Quinine, I don't think use ticlopidine very much anymore. HIV and collagen vascular diseases. Chemotherapy such as mitomycin, that could be a board test question. And then bone marrow transplant can trigger this. So you need to have two things for your diagnosis. You need to have thrombocytopenia, and you need to have schistocytic hemolytic anemia. So it's the shearing off of the red blood cells rather than the destruction of the red blood cells. And they have a different picture on your blood smear, so review your blood smear with your pathologist. Not all of them will have neurological events or renal impairment, or fever. So mild ones can occasionally just be treated with prednisone, but if they're deteriorating, they're going to need plasma exchange. This is different from plasmapheresis, where pheresis, the plasma is taken off and replaced with a pheresis solution. Plasma exchange, it's replaced with donor plasma. Sometimes you may just need to give the patient prednisone until you can get your pheresis catheters placed, just to buy some time, or some plasma infusions until you can buy some time till that can be all set up. So it used to be thought the hemolytic uremic syndrome was just the child variant of TTP, but we know now in the past 8 or 9 years that that's not the case. So it's a distinct syndrome. And the etiology is E. coli gastroenteritis. And this variant of E. coli is an infectious disease caused by a transfer of the gene from Shigella dysenteria to a strain of enteropathic E. coli. So often in children, it's just supportive. But in adults, you may need plasma infusion or pheresis for severe HUS, or maybe eculizumab or Soliris. So let's think about thrombocytopenia in the outpatients. Some of the most common one you'll see is ITP, or if they have enlarged spleen from whatever reason. Secondary disorders such as SLE or lymphoproliferative disorders, aplasia or myelodysplasia. So primary immune thrombocytopenia, purpura, you're going to have the rest of your CBC is totally normal. There's going to be no other picture of any other hematological disorders. There's going to be no drugs that the patient's taken, no viral infections, no other disease disorders are present. So what happens is that there's antibodies against the platelets that causes rapid platelet destruction. These antibodies are also to the megakaryocytes and causes suppression of thrombopoiesis. So when you do your workup on these patients, remember to get HIV and HCV testing. Rarely do you need to do a bone marrow biopsy on these patients, or even platelet antibody study testing when they have classic presentation. So we've decreased the platelet count for when we start treatment. It used to be 50,000, now it's down to 30,000. And although if the patient's bleeding and has a platelet count of less than 50,000, that would be an indication for treatment, or if they have risk factors for bleeding, such as a history of peptic ulcer disease. Generally, they don't need hospitalization unless they are non-compliant patients or have started to develop some significant mucous membrane bleeding and their platelet count is less than 20,000. Treatment is still standard prednisone, 1 mg/kg, and you usually should see an improvement in these patients in 3 days, with maximum improvement you usually see in 2 weeks. And this allows increased platelet production, reduces the destruction, and it works also on the megakaryocytes. So dexamethasone can be used, but there's a much higher relapse in the first 3 months. Other drugs that can be used are listed there. IVIG is a common one, as well as rituximab. I'd say that the thrombopoietin agonist, if you've heard of them, and platelet Promacta, don't really treat the underlying disorder. They just cause they don't take care of the antibody problem. They just cause the megakaryocytes to try to make more platelets, which in my mind actually propagates the problem. So here's some pearls for platelet transfusions. The best thing you can do is avoid platelet transfusion in anybody, if at all possible, because that first platelet transfusion sets up the production of antibodies in that patient. But the American Red Cross recommendations are to transfuse them with platelets if the platelet count is less than 50,000 and the patient is bleeding. If the patient's platelet count is less than 5,000, you may want to consider it, but these patients are usually in the hospital being watched very closely, and generally these patients are undergoing chemotherapy for leukemia when you see it that low. If they are an ITP patient, we've had them down as low as 2,000 and 3,000. Please don't transfuse those patients because you're only going to propagate the problem unless they're bleeding. And then the weirdest one is you can have dysfunctional platelets and have a totally normal platelet count, and these patients do require transfusions of platelets before any surgery. So a rule of thumb is 1 unit of single donor, which is apheresis platelets, equals about 6 units of random donor platelets, and a good response is a rise of about 30,000 1 hour after transfusion, which is the best time to get your platelet count after platelet transfusion, as opposed to red blood cells, where you usually need to wait 16 to 18 hours after transfusion of red blood cells to allow for fluid equilibration. So some inherited platelet disorders that you may have heard about, these are ones just don't have functional platelets, and bleeding can present usually at birth, but at any time down the road. And then, of course, we always think about platelet dysfunction in patients with a variety of medications, especially our aspirins and other NSAIDs. So we'll move over to hemostasis. So hemophilia is a defect in the thrombin propagation phase of coagulation. So these have, everything is normal except the factor 8 and factor 9. I apologize for these slides. I'm not sure why they're this way. Otherwise, all your other testing should be normal. So your bleeding is usually a function of severity. And I apologize again, you can hardly read this. Usually the patients don't have problems with bleeding until their factor is less than 5,000. On your computers, do you have it? So it's like you can hardly read it? I apologize. Maybe we can get you sent new copies of these slides. So the most common is mucocutaneous, but as it becomes more severe, you can see those spontaneous bleeding into joints. These patients need factor replacement, and they really need to be cared for at a bleeding disorder clinic lifelong. So one thing you guys have to think about is acquired hemophilia. So these patients can all of a sudden develop bleeding, especially postoperatively, and it's because they developed an inhibitor. And the causes of inhibitors you can see in the postpartum period, autoimmune disease, because an inhibitor is an antibody. So any disease process that's causing antibodies can contribute to this. Malignancy can cause this in a drug reaction. So many of them are severe enough to require transfusions, and some are severe enough that has caused death. Sometimes they can be treated with appropriate factor replacement, and then the long-term treatment is trying to suppress the antibody. Then there's von Willebrand's disease. I can't even read this. So generally, these patients have a family history of bleeding. Usually see this in young women. They're going to tell you they have very heavy periods, and those should be worked up to see if there's any sign of von Willebrand's disease or other bleeding disorders. So in these, they are going to have more issues with other things being abnormal. It won't just be the factor 8 and factor 9. You're going to have risdiplam cofactor, and your von Willebrand's factor will be low. So there's three types. One is quantitative, two is qualitative, and then three is a total deficiency. And I gave you this chart just for reference for you that you can refer to that, but I don't think this is going to be on your test. So these patients are generally can be treated, especially the mild ones, with DDAVP. It's pretty rare to have more severe bleeding. If you do, those need to be cared for in a bleeding disorder clinic. So let's move over to thrombosis. So this is pathological blood clotting. Oh my goodness. So there's a multitude of reasons why a person has a hypercoagulable state. As you know, you've seen all of these as listed below. So all of them, the acquired or the inherited ones, increase your risk factors, antithrombin 3, protein C and protein S, as well as factor 5 Leiden and prothrombin gene mutation all increase your risk. And then if you are heterozygous, it may only be about 4 times the population. If you're homozygous for factor 5 Leiden or prothrombin gene mutation, it could be 10 times the population. And then when you add more than one together, I have had patients that have had more than one inherited and acquired hypercoagulable state, it increases your risk again. So, I'm sorry, I can't even hardly read this. So so think about those that you need to test. So if a person is under 50 and they have a family history of thrombosis, and they have their first thrombosis, you might want to test them. Patients who are those that you don't need to test or don't really think you need to test, those that are over 50, if they have a thrombosis with an active cancer, elderly patients, especially in the post-op period, we get consults regular basis for 80-year-old lady who had a post-op thrombosis and no prior history. I don't think those really need to be tested because what are you going to do with that information? And then women who are starting birth control pills who don't have a family history or personal history of thrombosis don't need to be tested. So your hypercoagulable workup, you get your factor 5 Leiden prothrombin gene mutation, and your protein C, protein S, get your anti-cardiolipin antibody, and your lupus anticoagulant. So the treatment of DVT is generally you want to have these patients on heparin for 5 days. And then you can start them on warfarin if that's what you're using on day one. And you're going to treat them 3 to 5 months. So we are now using the direct oral anticoagulants. Here in the United States, we have Pradaxa, Xarelto, and Eliquis. Please make sure that you know your drug that you're prescribing. So, when not to use. And this is really important. I'm sorry that this is so hard to read. So, don't use them in pregnancy-related VTE. Don't use them in cancer-related VTE. Those should be a low molecular weight heparin. Don't use them in patients who are obese, over 275 pounds. Don't use them in the fragile patient of less than 100 pounds. And don't use them with a creatinine clearance of less than 30. And be very careful in patients whose creatinine clearance is 30 to 40. So the duration of anticoagulation therapy. So the first isolated one, 3 to 6 months, depending on the severity of nature of the anticoagulant of the thrombosis. Is it a peripheral pulmonary emboli or is it a saddle emboli? Those are all the things that you should think about when you're thinking about your duration. So some special considerations. If the patient has cancer, has it resolved? You can probably stop your anticoagulation. Do they have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome? The most common one, the lupus anticoagulant, is the most thrombogenic of all of them. Do they still have that being positive? We don't give that diagnosis until they have are rechecked about 3 months after the first one. And then if it's still positive, then they have that diagnosis. This can come and go. Usually after 3 months, if they still have it, it's probably not going to go away. And then it's hard to make that decision when to stop the anticoagulant, especially if you've rechecked your Dopplers and you see that they still have residual blood clot. And then other ones to think about is if they have multiple genetic hypercoagulable state issues, multiple genetic defects. So criteria for long-term oral anticoagulation. So no resolution of your risk factors. Think about that, especially a person with cancer. Sites and severities of the thrombosis, like I mentioned. More than one thrombogenic defect, and their risk of bleeding and their lifestyle. I had one guy who didn't have resolution of his DVT in his leg, but he and his buddies, for fun, went out and did a Marine boot camp on weekends. And so that's really not a good thing to be doing when you're on anticoagulation, so he elected to stop his anticoagulation. You also have to think of your non-compliant patient. I'd also put in a plug here for hospitals. Please don't get your hypercoagulable workup in the hospital. You should get it about 4 weeks after the event. Those inflammatory proteins that are floating around in the patient's blood are going to sometimes inhibit or cause some of the tests to be inaccurate. And then the hospital doesn't get reimbursed for these send-out tests with all our payments and the way that hospitals are reimbursed. So many of your information that you get from that will be inaccurate. So I would say just wait for your 4 weeks and get it, if you think the patient needs it, get it after that.